Okay. All right, so I guess we get started. So like I said, there'll be, let me just go through the syllabus real quick, and then we'll get to the first lecture. Now, this course, this is general relativity, and all you guys have had classes with me before, one or more, so you're pretty familiar with me and how I operate and et cetera. So the idea of this class is this is a graduate level course introducing Einstein's general theory of relativity. And the way this course is structured is that we're going to spend most of the time going over fundamentals, which is going to be reviewing special relativity, doing some things with, building up the theory behind the curvature of space-time, using tensors, manifolds, classical field theory, all the above, in order to kind of construct Einstein's general theory of relativity. And then the second half is actually doing applications of it and looking at black holes and then eventually getting to gravitational waves and cosmology. So it's a lot of the interesting physics is going to come towards the end. Everything you need to know to start this course, you've covered between math methods and the electrodynamics course, which 5331. And so really, it's the 5331 is the stuff you're going to mostly use. And so a lot of this is going to look familiar from Electro Jackson. If anything looks unfamiliar, you can go back and look at Jackson, or you can look at one of the other texts. But it should all, it's all in there, and it's all available for you. The textbook I chose for this is Sean Carroll's book, Space-Time and Geometry, Intro to General Relativity. There is a bigger book, I didn't bring it, by Messner, Thorne, and Wheeler called Gravitation. It's about this thick. It's black, has its own gravitational field, has everything you need to know about general relativity. Unfortunately, it's like 1,500 pages long, and so there is no time to read the entire thing in a semester course, but it's almost like a Bible. What happened is Carroll actually wrote this book based on some class notes that he wrote for a general relativity class at MIT, which is based on MTW. So this is like a condensed version of that big, thick book. If there's anything you need the better explanation for, you can go to that big book. There might be a copy of it in a library you can check out or reference. Also, there are these lecture notes. These are the original lecture notes that Carroll put out that the book is based on. So it's kind of the first draft. And if you're familiar with the archive, Physics Archive, GRQC, this is the number for that, those notes. So you can actually go online and download these notes for free and print them out. And then you can see everything else here. And included in here is a list of all the typos in the book. So if you see something that doesn't look right in the book, check here, and it might explain exactly why it doesn't look right. And also, this is the website where I'm going to be keeping the audio files and the lecture notes. So before every lecture, you know, the notes are going to be on there. Some of the notes are already up there for most of the semester. And I'm also going to upload the audio files. And like I said, I'm going to have to be a little creative because these WAV files I'm recording, for a 2.5-hour class, they come out to like 100 megabytes. And so I learned that if I compress them down into MP3s, I can get them down to something on the order of like 20, 25. And then I'm going to basically put those in a cloud and link them to this website. So in theory, you should be able to just click on it and listen to it online without having to download anything. But if we do run short on space, what will happen is I might have like 6 or 10 or however many lectures online and then just start deleting the earliest ones. So, you know, I say don't wait till the last minute at the end of the semester to start listening to those. And the idea of this is that you can look at the notes that or online and that I handed out to you today. After today, I'd expect you to bring your own notes in, so just print them out at home. And then as we're going through the notes, you can, you know, make your own notes in the margin. It saves you a lot of time of having to write these down off of the board. And then, you know, hopefully this works out pretty well. And like I said, this is sort of an experiment because I didn't want to do it just have the notes on the computer and do with the Wimba type of way. And I'm actually thinking of using the same format for the math methods course in the fall, so you guys are my guinea pig. I have office hours Tuesday, Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. and or by appointment. And what that means is that you should probably try to email me ahead of time, but otherwise you can pretty much, I'm going to be, or at least make an attempt to be around Tuesday, Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. I'm not planning any trips out of town, although I was thinking about going for the, trying to go for the shuttle launch.
Oh, yeah.
And so if we do, then we're not going to have class that Thursday. And I know you guys are bummed out by that thought. But I don't know, how many other people are thinking about going down for that? Okay. Just one other? Okay. Well, we'll see. But, you know, if we do have a class, it'll be recorded. If not, then you guys get a day off. And the way this class is going to work, there's going to be several problem sets and one take-home exam. There are going to be no in-class exams. That means that, you know, you pretty much, everything you do, all the really good general relativity problems are not things that you can really work out on an exam in the course of working out, you know, three or four problems in the course of 2 hours. So that's kind of why that is. And I'm going 50-50 between the problem sets and the class exams. And as usual, you can work in groups on the problem sets. On the take-home final, I do expect that to just be your own work. And that take-home final is going to be kind of like, I'm not sure if it's going to be sort of applying the stuff you learned to the very last stuff that we're doing in the course, which will probably be more cosmology and gravitational waves, or if it's going to be kind of a conglomeration of the other stuff. But it'll be one of those two. And this is just to give you an idea of the grade boundaries. Basically, all this means is if you work hard and you actually are paying attention in lecture or reviewing the notes and reviewing the audio files, then you're going to do really well. And if you don't pay attention or don't do anything, you're not going to do very well. And since these are all take-home problem sets, things like that, you know, there's not really the traditional time pressure of having to do everything on the fly in a short amount of time. This is the honesty code, which basically says that if you anything you turn into me is effectively your work. You're not just photocopying somebody else's and handing it to me. And also that, you know, when it comes to the take-home final, that's your work. And so, you know, I don't want copying. I mean, there, you know, should be very limited communication on something like that. For the makeups, you know, of course, makeup exams, it shouldn't really be an issue here. But this is basically saying that unless there's a real problem, I expect you to, you know, get me the exam at the end when it's due. As far as problem sets go, this is not a core course like the other courses. And since it's not a core course, this is kind of fluid as far as what we cover and how much we cover. So if, you know, you guys want more depth and you need me to slow down, we can do that. And we can take time off to cover, you know, a little bit deeper or explain material a little bit better. There's no rush that says we have to get up to Chapter 8 this summer. So if there's problem sets that are due and there's becomes issues with them, let me know. And then finally, it's a disability accommodation statement where basically, if you have a disability, let me know. Again, I don't think this is going to be really an issue since most of this applies to if you have a learning disorder and you need more time for an exam. But since these are take-home exams and take-home problem sets, that shouldn't really be an issue here. And so the plan, and you know, we're doing two lectures a week, and we have up to 2.5 hours each time. And so the plan is, in the first three lectures, we're going to basically do a math review and talk about special relativity. And the next three lectures, we're going to be talking about space-time manifolds. And then the next two lectures, we're going to hit space-time curvature. And then the three lectures after that, we're going to put it all together into gravitation. And then from there, things move a little bit quicker when we start basically getting into applications. And so the first applications are talking about black holes and the Schwarzschild metric, and then getting into gravitational waves and cosmology. Okay. So, are there any questions about what we're doing or how this is going to work this semester? Okay. And like I said, what I'm going to do is... some of this stuff, especially at the beginning, there's a lot of words. I don't want to have to just write them on the board. And effectively, I'm going to be kind of switching between using the board and going through the notes, but I expect you to kind of take your own notes. And hopefully this is going to be pretty relevant and pretty clear. So everybody should have a copy of these. And like I said, it's going to be... all this is going to be effectively on the web as well. And you guys, if you have a problem with the website, let me know. And also, give me at least, say, 24 hours to get the audio posted. Because, especially the first week, I don't know what I'm going to run into. But all this stuff you should be able to review. So I'd say today's note should be up by sometime tomorrow. And Thursday's note should be up by sometime Friday. Okay. All right. Well, like I said in the book, I'm really starting off in chapter one on this. And we are going through the book in order because, you know, this is one of the few textbooks I've found where I actually agree with the order of the author and how he likes to cover things. And I didn't pick this book lightly either. I chose this book back right as the first edition was coming out. And I remember actually when I was in grad school, when I took my general relativity course, we used a book by Wald. And I didn't really like it. And what I ended up doing was I got through the class using Sean Carroll's notes, which were already out there and, you know, pretty useful. And then, you know, when he came by to visit, and he was a postdoc at the time, I had him actually autograph my copy of him because I used it so much. So this is actually a very, very good overview of general relativity and most of the things you need to know. You'll notice the one part of the book that we're not planning to cover is the last chapter, which is on quantum field theory and curved space-time. Just kind of bites off a whole lot there. And so... the reason why we're not covering it is because of time for the most part, and also, you know, there's a good reason why it has to be there because that was sort of the cutting edge stuff, but also it's changing so quickly that there's a lot of quantum theory and grand unification theory stuff that isn't even, you know, the best example of in here. And so we're mostly focusing on the classical stuff. So, in the first section, you talk about a prelude, which is just the essential idea of general relativity. And so, the idea here is that when you talk about the four forces of nature, there's the weak force, the strong force, the electromagnetic force, and gravity. And everybody's familiar with gravity. And electromagnetic force, we talked a lot about in the electrodynamics course with Jackson. And so when you look at the Jackson, that's the best example of a force that we really understand, at least classically. When you get to the weak and the strong force, it gets a little fuzzy, and you really have to use quantum mechanics. And so all these forces are defined by fields. And in the electromagnetic force, you've got the electric field and the magnetic field. In the core force of gravity, gravity was early on by Newton, it was described as kind of the gravitational field. But under Einstein, it's thought to be inherent in the space-time itself. So gravity, in that sense, isn't so much a force as it's an effect. And we still consider it a force because we don't really know what's causing the effect. You know, exactly how does space-time get curved by matter? And, you know, we just know that it happens. And we know mathematically how to describe it. And so gravity is thought to be a manifestation of the curvature of space-time, which technically is not a force. But, again, what else can you call it? And so if you want to understand gravity, you need to understand space-time, and you need to understand how curvature becomes gravity. And so that's basically the theme of the first half of this course. And if you look at the different chapters, you know, we got the basic math, then we talk about manifolds and curvature and then gravity. All that's just building up to that simple Einstein equation where it has curvature equals stress energy tensor. And so, you know, we spend several weeks talking about that. And so in chapter 1 and 2 are going to be talking about the space-time. And the first part, of course, is math and tensors and, you know, a little bit about the classical fields and stuff. And so this first chapter is going to feel really fast to you guys because it's going to go through a lot of stuff that's taken you a long time to learn between math methods and between the electrodynamics class, and there's probably going to be at least one or two new things in there. The chapter 2 is going to be on manifolds, and that manifolds are basically a geometric, you know, used to be called theoretical geometry, but now it's, you know, useful geometry for physicists, which basically talks about what it is we mean when we're talking about curvature and what is being curved and how to describe the space-time mathematically. Then in chapter 3, that's when we get into curvature. And that's kind of going back to some stuff that we learned in math methods, but it's going to go a lot further. Because you're going to start off, you know, we cover tensors in the first chapter, tensors again in the second chapter, and he literally calls the section tensors again. And then in the third chapter, you get into stuff like covariant derivatives, which we talked about in math methods, and talking about the connections, which are called the Christoffel symbols, which we talked about a little bit in math methods. And then the chapter 4 is where he actually links the curvature with gravity. And so what happened basically is chapter 1 through 3, this is all stuff that was pre-Einstein. This was stuff with Riemann and other people have kind of developed. Outside of special relativity, everything else here was pretty much known in mathematics. And then Einstein had to kind of educate himself on the mathematics and geometry and then link it to gravity as a force. And in doing that, that's where he kind of replaced Newton. And so if you want to have a gravity theory, there's basically two basic elements to it. Part one is that you need to describe how the gravitational fields are affected by matter. Because everybody knows that, you know, if you have a gravitational field like, say, the Earth, or around the Earth, that the Earth is the cause of that gravitational field. You don't just get a gravitational field without putting a body in it. So they had to describe how matter influences this gravitational field. And the second part of that is how matter responds to gravitational field. So in other words, you take this pencil in the Earth's gravitational field, you drop it, it falls. And then there's kind of the question raised, why does it fall exactly towards the center of the Earth? Why does it fall at exactly 9.8 meters per second per second? All these things need to be described. And so if you can explain these two things mathematically, then you have a full theory of gravity. And so, you know, the famous Einstein equation where you have the curvature equals the stress-energy tensor, that's just the first part. The second part is known as the geodesic equation, which is describing how a particle follows a gravitational field. And so we're going to get into both of those. But what we do is we use Newton's theory as a model to show how gravity works, or how a classical gravitational theory works. And in Newton's theory, you've got force equal to minus Newton's constant times the mass of the gravitating object, the mass of the object being affected by gravity, divided by the distance between the two squared, along the line of separation between the two. So you might have the Earth and the Moon, for example. And you notice this follows an inverse square law, which works pretty well, and it looks a lot like electromagnetic fields, Coulomb electric field. And so this is related to Newton's second law, which says that force is equal to mass times acceleration, where all of this is just the acceleration of gravity. We also know that acceleration can be thought of as being the gradient of a potential. So if you take the gradient of some, like if you look at electric potential, and you take the gradient of that electric potential, then you get basically a force per unit mass or acceleration. And, you know, actually in that case, they also throw charge into it. So it would be actually like force per unit charge, and then you multiply by charge and you get force. So here, the charge is the mass. And so what this means is that when you're talking about electromagnetic force, everything carries its own charge, and how it responds to that field depends on its charge. Positive charge goes one way, negative charge goes the other way. When you talk about matter and gravity, everything has the same charge, and the charge is its mass. You add more mass, you got more charge. But you don't have negative mass that responds negatively to gravitational fields. At least we don't know that there is yet. And so if you look at this and you compare it to the potential, then you can say that, first off, minus the gradient of potential is acceleration, but also this potential follows a Poisson equation, which is described by this. So this is basically the Poisson equation describing Newton's gravitational potential.
That G is just a gravitational constant?
Yeah, this is function. Right. This is just the gravitational constant, nothing ugly like a Green's function. Matter of fact, you won't even see Green's functions in here too much. not like Electro. I can't say not at all, but at least they don't show up as much. So, for general relativity, what you're going to do is you're going to replace these equations with ones involving the curvature of space-time. In this case, you've got the curvature of the space-time, which is described by this r mu nu, and this r mu nu is called the Ricci tensor. And it's basically derived from the space-time metric g mu nu. And so the space-time metric, as you remember from like math methods, is like this little term, which I can find some chalk. The idea is that if you want to describe the distance between two points, can everybody read this? This is described in space-time. It's minus dt squared, minus g00 dt squared plus g11 dx squared plus g12 dx dy plus G22 dy squared, etc. And you can expand this over all the different dimensions. And so what happens is this G term here, and also I use the fact that I put a minus sign here and plus signs with all the rest of them. That's kind of known as the signature of the metric, which you guys are familiar with. But the idea here is that by essentially defining what G is, you get to describe how space-time is curved and whether you're dealing with the Cartesian coordinate system or some other coordinate system. So this could be Cartesian, this could be spherical, this could be cylindrical, it could be whatever you want, and it all comes down to G. And so what the Ricci is that when you take certain derivatives of G, you get the Christoffel symbol. When you take derivatives of that, you get the Riemann tensor. You contract the Riemann tensor, you get the Ricci tensor. And also in this, they're using a convention that we use a lot in general relativity, and that is if you use Greek indices, everything goes from 0 to 3, or if you're a particle physicist, 1 to 4. If you see Latin indices, like, you know, ABC as opposed to mu, nu, gamma, then it goes from 1 to 3. So this covers just space with Latin. Greek covers space and time, which means that this equation here for the curvature of space-time, mu and nu can be anywhere from 0 to 3. And they can cover time, and they can cover space, everything else. So you're not just covering, you're not just curving space, you're also curving time as well. And everything here is derived from the metric, which sort of explains what the geometry of the space is. And what happens is, when you do this whole thing, and you know, you go from the metric, and you take its derivatives, and you get to a connection term, or the Christoffel symbol, and then you go from there to the Riemann, and you contract it, you're getting something unique that you can't just, which is sort of something you can't just transform away. And then you contract this Ricci to the Ricci scalar, and when you do that, you're going to get basically just a scalar number, and that scalar number is going to describe the curvature. And it doesn't matter how you do a transformation of the coordinates or whatever, if it's zero, there's no curvature. If it's positive, then there's curvature in a positive direction. If it's negative, curvature in a negative direction. It doesn't transform away. And again, we're going to go more into the math on that later on. On the right-hand side of Einstein's equations, there is the mass-energy term. And this G, again, is not a Green's function. It is Newton's gravity constant. And so these are all basically constants, so we don't pay attention to those parts. All we care about is this part, the stress-energy tensor. And that stress-energy tensor is basically the same as the Maxwell stress-energy tensor that you studied in electrodynamics. And so this describes the energy distribution of whatever your system is. So this equation put together tells you how energy relates to curvature, or how having a massive object can curve the space-time around it, which, you know, yields gravity. And so this is half of gravity, the gravity equation or theory. The other half is the geodesic equation, which is right here. And this geodesic equation basically describes how a particle moves in a gravitational field. Now, what's happening is you have X here, which represents position, but it's got a Greek indice, which means this could be time or it could be space. And you have lambda, which is known as an affine parameter. This is one of these things that they don't tend to define very well in any of the general relativity textbooks I've read. And it's one of those things you have to read many times to understand what it is. But basically, it's sort of like something that's taking in, a standing in for time or proper time. And you need something like that because, as you know, in relativity, time is relative. So you can take, you know, switch from one observer to another, and time is different. And so you have this thing that's sort of like time, or parameterizes like time, but it's not exactly time because this is not relative. And so if you were to take the derivative of time with respect to that, that's different than taking a derivative of time with respect to time, although not much different. But loosely, we can interpret this as being like time. So if you take the derivative of, say, let's say you have an object around the Earth, and it's radially falling. What happens is you could take this to be the radial direction. And so this can be interpreted as the second derivative or acceleration of that particle with respect to time. And if you remove all the curvature of space-time, then the Christoffel symbol disappears. If you have a, you know, Cartesian grid, you know, Cartesian coordinates, this goes away. Then you just have acceleration is equal to zero. And what that means is that if you have a space-time, which is flat, nothing interesting going on, no curvature, then an object is not going to accelerate due to gravity. But you throw in curvature here, and this is non-zero, and now these look like velocity terms, sort of. Then you can get something that might accelerate. And so this is the geodesic equation because it basically says how an object put into a curved space-time is going to move. So you put these together, you've got how does mass curve space-time? How does mass tell space-time how to curve? How does curved space tell mass how to move? And, you know, in most cases, like if you look at a, you know, an object around the Earth, okay, dot is pretty boring, you know. It's Newton solved that hundreds of years ago. But you get into something interesting, like you just have, like, say, just an object and a gravitational wave passes by, where the gravity is actually fluctuating up and down, and you can actually see the thing moving. That's when it gets kind of interesting. So what this means is, in a relativistic view, gravity is not actually a force. It's a feature of the space-time. Forces actually move through space-time. Gravity is space-time. And a particle moving along a geodesic path is not going to feel... And the geodesic path is kind of written as this position parameterized by lambda or like time. And this can represent everywhere in time and space. Does not feel any acceleration like a charged particle would feel in a B field. The reason why is because you're moving with the space-time. It's kind of like if you're riding a wave. And if you're always riding with the wave, you don't really feel the wave moving. If you're outside and you're watching the wave pass by, you see it moving. And so it's kind of, you know, gets a little deep. But you can kind of picture what that means is that, you know, if you're, the only time you can really feel weightless is if you are on free fall. Like, especially if you can just get rid of the air resistance and you just go skydiving. Or if, you know, if you're in a vomit comet or if you're in microgravity on the International Space Station. These are the only times when you can feel weightless because you're constantly falling with everything else. And you're moving along a geodesic path. Where we are right now, we're kind of cut off from our geodesic path because we have this ground underneath us. So we're not falling. And so an example of this is if you have a ball that's falling, it's following a geodesic path. If you have a ball sitting on a table, it's not following a geodesic path. And so you get some interesting things with just dealing with the space-time itself. A really good, cool example of this, and I guess you can understand it better later on in the semester, is the Alcubierre warp drive. Like, everybody's seen Star Trek. Basically what happened was a guy, he actually looked at that and thought, well, how does that thing actually work? and he kind of wrote up the equations for how a warp drive would actually work. And essentially, the idea is that instead of moving faster than light through space-time, which is where you get all this resistance, because, you know, you're constantly running into stuff, what if the space-time moved and you just moved with it? And the idea is that space-time can expand as fast as it wants to. There's no speed limit for how fast it can move. But there's a speed of light limit on how fast you can move through space-time. And that's kind of the difference here. This metric tensor is something you're going to use a lot in this course. And it's something you're going to be the most familiar with by the end. That's going to describe, for lack of a better way of understanding it, it's going to describe space-time curvature. But that's not really an accurate statement. It's going to describe space-time geometry. And then the geometry is going to describe the curvature, because what's going to happen is all that stuff that you learned about coordinate transformations and things, all that kind of takes place here and allows you to kind of decide which geometry you're dealing with. And with curvature, we also got to modify our idea of geometry and what that means. So, you know, gone are the days when we thought of geometry where, you know, you got a triangle and you're just trying to calculate a couple angles and things like that. We're in a totally new ballpark here. So, the metric in flat space is going to be represented like this. This is the absolute simplest metric you can get. It's known as the Minkowski metric. And we'll see that referred to a lot. And so the basic idea, when you see Minkowski, it means flat metric. And you'll notice here, there are no cross terms. There are no terms between dt and dx, or dx and dy, because essentially this is a space-time where all of these coordinates are orthogonal to each other. And you can get geometries where the dimensions are not orthogonal to each other. They're still separate dimensions, but they're not orthogonal. In curved space, what happens is Pythagoras' theorem is going to be altered, and the metric is going to contain information about how these things are altered. So that's going to be another important thing here. Also, this is a relationship about kind of the evolution of the mathematics that we're going to go through. You start off with the metric, and this is going to be everything. If you describe the metric, you can go everywhere else you want, and this is about the information that our small minds can handle. It's just keeping up with this guy. Everything else, it gets much more complicated, because keep in mind, mu and nu go from 0 to 3, right? That means that there are 16 elements here. But it's symmetric, so it actually is only 10, so it's a little bit better. You go from this, I kind of skipped a step with the connection or the Christoffel symbol, but you get to the Riemann tensor. You notice these also go from 0 to 3. So that means that there are 4, 4, 4, 4, which is what? Yeah, 64. Actually, no, 64 times 4.
256.
Thank you. 256 elements here. So this is not something you're going to calculate in your head. Unless you're talking about Minkowski. So unless you stick with something incredibly simple, this is going to get very big and complicated. And also what we're going to do later on, hopefully in the semester we get to it, is when we talk about gravitational waves, we're actually talking about perturbations. So you're taking, like, say, this Minkowski metric and you're perturbing it slightly, in which case you can kind of get a linear progression, which is a little bit easier to handle mathematically. Then what happens here is you're actually contracting over a couple of these indices. So you might raise this last indice and contract those two together, and this gets you back down to the Ricci tensor, which is just 16 elements again. And then from the Ricci tensor, you can contract that again to get the Ricci scalar, and you can write Einstein's equations to the left-hand side. And also, you can write the geodesic equation, because for the geodesic equation, all you really need is this Christoffel symbol, which was even easier. So you can imagine how mathematically intense this could get, especially when you're talking about 256 elements. And that's why it is that, you know, there aren't like billions and billions of known solutions to Einstein's equations. When Einstein first came out with his general theory of relativity, it was in 1915, and he thought, well, this is a really interesting equations or set of equations, and basically he was talking about this equation here. And he thought it would probably be decades before anybody would solve the equation. Can anybody guess how long it took for somebody to solve it?
6 months.
Yeah, about. Yeah, 1916, first solution to Einstein's equation were found. And they thought, man, that was fast. Unfortunately, that was the Schwarzschild solution, which actually describes, later on it was used to describe black holes, but also at the time, it actually describes any kind of point mass and the gravitational field around it. So it can be used to describe the gravitational field around the Earth. And it's a really interesting solution. But part of the history on that is Schwarzschild never got to really claim credit for it, because at the time he was it was World War II, and he was fighting on the front lines in Germany.
World War I.
World War I, thank you. And so he didn't live out of that. I don't know, I kind of always pictured him like sitting there in a foxhole writing out these equations and thinking, yes, I solved it. And that was it. But who knows? So the real difficulty of general relativity, well, part of it is the math. And without the computers, you can't really get past this math. Nowadays, you know, you can use Mathematica or Maple or some other package, and you can go from a metric to a Riemann or Ricci tensor in, you know, a few seconds or minutes. And just a matter of just coding it all in. The real difficulty of general relativity is accepting the concept of space-time curvature that you can't really observe in real life. And so what this means is that when we talk about relativity, there's a conceptual issue and there's a mathematical issue, and both of them are difficult. So if you can get past the math, and you know, now with the computers we can do that, and at least once during the course of this semester, you're going to have to grind through the math by hand to really get a good understanding and feel for it. But the whole conceptual thing is actually thinking that the space-time we're sitting on is not flat, it's actually curved. Which is a lot like when people thought the world was flat, and then they had to get used to the idea that we're actually living on a curved sphere. Now, when you look at the difference between Einstein and Newton, the biggest difference is going to be this thing called a manifold. And the manifold is a very mathematical concept. It basically is the mathematical structure that we're going to use to describe space-time. And it's not like anything you've seen in Newton's gravity. And this is one of the reasons why I think it was about a 10-year gap between special relativity and general relativity, is Einstein was trying to learn the math. And so the manifold describes geometry in the sense of what we're doing in the most general terms. And special relativity, which you're all familiar with, this is basically a model for one kind of space-time, where it's just flat space-time, Minkowski space-time, and if you take general relativity and all the stuff we got out of general relativity, reduce it to Minkowski space-time with that metric, everything works, and everything looks exactly like special relativity. And one of the principles of general relativity is that if you could do a coordinate transformation of your space-time to make it at least in one little local place to look like Minkowski space, which you can do in one place but not globally, then it should still work with special relativity. If it doesn't, you're wrong somewhere. And so what we're going to do is we're going to reintroduce special relativity as a theory of the structure of space-time, and it's going to replace Newton's mechanics. And then we're going to bring in the idea of the manifold in order to get this up to the full GR. And so space-time is going to be 3 + 1 dimensions. Four-dimensional space, which is going to be a set of three space dimensions and one time dimensions. And that's our universe we're going to be living in. And an event, whenever we use that term event, it's going to represent a single point in space-time. So it's going to be a time and a place. So like when we say the class is going to start in this room at 6 o'clock, that's the event. A path of a particle is going to be a curve traveling through the space-time. So it's just going to represent not just traveling through space, but through time. And you could almost imagine the path you took into the building from the parking lot to the room. And it's not just where you went, but when you were at certain places. So that if you cross by somebody, it has to be at a certain time and place. And also, we're going to use the term world line, where a world line is a parameterized one-dimensional set of events. And so if you just take a bunch of events and you play connect the dots, so again, you know, picture your path walking into the building today, and if you just, like say every second, you just kind of say, I was here at this second, here at this second, here at this second, then you construct a world line of that. And so it's almost like you can imagine a, you know, form kind of a tube following your path. And then you'll note that time and space are treated differently, and a particle can move anywhere it wants in space, but it can only move forward in time. This is true for the most part. The only time where this actually becomes different is inside a black hole, and that's when it gets really cool. Because inside a black hole, you can move anywhere you want in time, but you have to move forward in space directly to the center of the black hole. Okay, you get a few months to wrap your head around that one. So. But it's really interesting, because that's one of the reasons why we want to get into these applications, because that's the only time you're going to witness something like that. And of course, you know, this is still a theory. Nobody's tested it out. And if they have tested it out, they're never coming back to tell you the results. So, you know, go from there. Simultaneity. Oh, sorry, I skipped one. In Newton's view of the universe, space-time involves all of space at a fixed moment in time. There's no relative time. So, to Newton, everything marched forward in time at the same rate. In Einstein's view, in special relativity, we know that if you're different, a different observer moving at a different speed or reference frame through space-time is going to see time changing differently. And the reason why is because if I draw these little stick figure space-time diagrams, where this is time and this represents space, then you have this thing called a light cone, where this light cone represents how light is traveling. So light is always moving along in space and in time at this fixed rate. We can travel anywhere up here inside of this light cone and travel less than the speed of light. So what happens is that if an observer is moving like this, he's moving more in time and less in space than this observer. And so if this person covers this distance ds from the origin from here to here, and this person covers this distance ds from here to here, this guy has traveled further in time than this one. And you notice the slower that you're moving in space, the further you're going to move in time, so that this kind of remains a constant. And so this is where the idea that, you know, as you move the speed of light, effectively what's happening here is you're moving just as far in time and space equally. And that's as far as you can go. If you can go faster than the speed of light, then eventually you reach the point where you're moving infinitely fast and you're not traveling at all in time and you're just moving in space. But to us, time effectively stops when you get to the speed of light. So, you know, that's the difference in Newton. And in Einstein's view, you can almost think of velocity as kind of a rotation in time and space. We've also got this thing called simultaneity. And simultaneity means, you know, two things happen at the same time. And what happens in special relativity is it's kind of poorly defined, because if you flip from one reference frame to another, you can take two things that you normally think of as happening at the same time for one observer, and they're not happening at the same time for another observer. An example could be fireworks blowing up, where if you're sitting still and they're equal distance from you, you see them at the same time. But what if you're closer to one than the other? You're just going to see this one closer than the other one because the light travel time is different. Or if you're running really, really fast and the light catches up to you for one before the other one does. So simultaneity becomes an issue in special relativity, and you'd expect it to also be an issue in general relativity. The light cone, which I talked about before over there, is basically a mathematically way of kind of defining the future and the past by how light travels and where we are in that. And so everything that travels slower than the speed of light is going to exist inside these light cones, where this is the future, or everything, time moving forward, and this is the past. And so to get to this point, you have to come from somewhere in the past light cone. And if you're at this point, you can't leave the light cone. You're going to always be somewhere inside of here. The speed of light is a limit in special relativity, but it's not a limit in Newton's theory. And the reason why, it kind of goes back to electrodynamics, where in Newton's theory, light effectively could move infinitely fast. And he didn't have a speed of light. So the fact that the speed of light is finite is why it is that, if the speed of light wasn't finite, if the speed of light was infinite, these light cones, these two angles here, would collapse all the way down here. You wouldn't have things like retarded potentials in electrodynamics. There's no speed limit, so you can travel as fast as you want. Information can travel infinitely fast. And so a lot of things that we just know, you know, wouldn't work in physics if light was infinitely fast. You wouldn't have any electromagnetic waves either. So, you know, so that's one other thing that's different. Also in relativity, there's no preferred coordinate system. And so what happens is when you change reference frames from the unprime to the prime reference frames, the distance delta S squared, which represents the distance between two points in space-time, is going to be a constant. And this is known as the space-time distance between events. And so what that means is, let's say you got two observers, and they're moving at different speeds along different space-time paths, and they run into each other. And then they get up, and one continues along his way, and the other one speeds around the building, and then crashes into him again. What's going to happen is, to both observers, there's going to be the same observed space-time distance between the two of them. Even though for one of them, time is shorter than the other one because of the relativistic time dilation. But the length contraction is going to make up for that, so it's going to end up being the same. And so what this means is that, like, in relativity, since ds squared is going to be the same for every observer, and our metric is defined by this, then even if you change these coordinate systems effectively, you know, your ds squared is still going to be the same. So if you change these from unprime to prime and you change your ds's, it might alter the metric, but the final answer is going to be the same. You know, or alter the metric in such a way that it ends up making no difference. The term inertial frame should be familiar to you guys, and this is the natural generalization of space-time created by local observations. And so what this is a fancy way of saying is that, you know, when we made the leap from classical physics with Newton to modern physics with Einstein, the one difference is that we have observers in modern physics. We don't have observers in classical physics. And so the inertial frame is defined by the observer. If the observer is moving at a certain rate compared to another observer, that's why they're different. And one way about to think of this is with 3D cameras. You know, everybody's kind of familiar how 3D cameras work. It's interesting how, like, after all these years, you know, they had 3D years ago, and now it's actually finding its way into technologies that people are buying, to the point where you can actually soon buy camera phones which actually take 3D images. And the way they work is basically, instead of just having one camera take an image, you have two cameras taking an image. They're both taking images from slightly different perspectives. Just like your eyes. We're looking at things from two different perspectives. And so when you take these two images, then you can kind of process the differences between them, and you get a 3D image. Likewise with this, it's the difference between in Newtonian relativity, or Newtonian's theory, it was almost like the 1D, just a standard one camera taking a 2D image, where just one perspective takes that picture, that's all there is. Here, it's almost like you have a 3D camera, where you actually have two different perspectives you can compare, and you can kind of go back and forth between the two and get a more complex image. And so this is how we use these inertial frames, like the two sides of a 3D image. And then space interval, or space-time interval, again, is defined as this thing, which is going to, in special relativity, this is how you define a space-time image. Yeah, because here, the metric is flat, and so you just have the time component corrected for the speed of light. So it's so these are all the same units. And then you have your positions in X, Y, and Z. And you're going to notice some conventions along the way, like sometimes people tend to set speed of light equal to 1 and Newton's gravity constant equal to 1. And that's just to kind of simplify things so you don't have a lot of G's and C's floating around. And then what happens is when you want to get it to the right units, you just put the C's and the G's back in to convert everything. And you'll notice that when you calculate this, this number, since this is negative and these are positive, the result can be positive, zero, or negative, which represent time-like, null-like, or space-like versions of the vector, whatever it is. Okay.
Wouldn't the time-like be the one in the case that's less than zero?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'll probably flip to the convention I'm used to without actually changing the math, but yeah. But yeah, you're right. The time-like would be the one which is negative. And that means that you're moving more in time than in space. And space-like would be the positive, which means that you're moving more in space than in time. And then the null-like is zero, or light-like. Okay. Now, the Minkowski space-time, and like I said, for at least the first chapter, this is the only space-time that we're going to really be worried about. And later on, we're going to start getting into more complicated geometries. In Cartesian coordinates, x mu, which is a covariant vector, is going to represent all four dimensions. So x0 is just speed of light times time. x1 is x, x2 is y, x3 is z, in Cartesian coordinates. And xi is a Latin indice, so this is only going to go over to spatial terms. And you have to be careful to keep in mind that, you know, if you're going to get this convention, you just have to stick to it. The metric is typically written like this. So it's basically an identity matrix, only the first term is minus to represent the fact that the time is different than the space. You can also see this written a lot where this is positive and the rest are negative. And it just depends on the signature and the convention they're using. So a lot of the goal of a master's degree in physics is to be able to just read these scientific papers and understand what's going on. So when you do read these papers, just pay attention to the signature, because otherwise things can get mixed up. And a well-written paper is going to define that. The space-time interval, you can just write like this. Because what happens is, you've got repeated indices here, which imply a summation. And so, if you take these as zero, then that's the delta zero terms up here, which would be the time-like part, or the time component. And then 1-1 would be the dx terms, and dy, dz, etc. So this is a very simple way of writing ds squared. And you could do the same with a curved space-time metric, where you're just basically just writing it as... where's my chalk? Well, you could just simply write it as ds squared is equal to g mu nu dx mu dx nu, like that. And then that's it. Actually, I shouldn't put a minus here. But. So, what happens is you can just write this thing, and that's the whole space-time interval, which is going to simplify some of your math a lot. Proper time is basically this interval with the minus sign in front. And so it's just minus this. And the reason why is because if you think about it, if you're not moving in space, then your proper time is just, proper time squared is just minus the time squared part. If you are moving in space, then your proper time is going to be decreased, and this is what you're going to get. So this actually works out pretty well. And you can use this as proper time for or how much time is passing. The line element is also another definition. You'll just see all these words in the text, and this is just what they're relating back to, where this is just ds squared, and again, it's just equal to this. But we're using d as opposed to delta. And the only real difference here is that you can integrate when you're talking about d's, not deltas. And so if you want to, for example, look at what is delta s, the distance between two events in space-time, you can take this term, ds squared, and you take the square root of it and then just integrate it. And you get s, right, or delta s. So what they do here is they take this term here, which is ds squared, but you're not just going to have these dx terms, these deltas of the different coordinates. You have to take derivatives of them with respect to something. And so here, we're using the affine parameter, and you can see that we're basically taking the derivative of each coordinate with respect to that parameter, which is the same thing as velocity. Because if you think about it, this is x, and this is like time, then this is like the derivative of position with respect to time. And this is actually 4 velocity of the particle. So this is really taking the metric times the 4 velocity of the particle with one direction and another one, contracting it with the metric, then taking the square root of that, and then integrating over that parameter, which is time. So if you take integrate velocity over time, you get distance traveled, right? So that's the whole thing this is saying. And then you do the same thing, but you throw a negative sign in here, and you get the time. And so in this case, you take something that looks like velocity, but it's imaginary with this minus sign, and you integrate that over time, and you get the proper time that's passed. So this is a little bit more abstract. This one you can kind of see where that came from. Another thing you guys should remember are Lorentz transformations, and this again goes right back to Jackson. And the idea here is that if, according to Einstein, you can basically think about these conversions in space-time as being like rotations. So in other words, velocity traveling more with respect to time than with space is like kind of rotating from being moving all full steam ahead in time to moving partially in time and partially in space. And so a Lorentz transformation kind of explains how you can take one of these and mathematically reorientate to be more or less time moving and more or less space moving. So it's a rotation in space-time that leaves the space-time distance intervals invariant for different inertial frames. And so you've got the translations, which are shift coordinates, and that basically a translation means you take your coordinate and you move it over by adding another vector to it. And so you're taking this vector and you're shifting it and creating a new vector. And mathematically it looks like this, because we just took a vector or a coordinate, added another vector to it, it's been shifted, and then we moved it from being unprimed to prime by using this delta function. And then we've got spatial rotations and boosts, where this represents the full Lorentz transformation matrix. And so what happens here is you have this position vector in position in space or time or coordinate, and you're contracting it with this transformation matrix, and you're getting a new position out of it. And so this is a transformation occurring on this vector. So you're going from this vector to this prime vector by using this transformation. And so you can do the inverse. It's the same thing as this from math methods. And so when you look at what's happening, delta S squared is to be invariant under this, because when delta S squared is the interval that comes from summing over all of these different intervals in the coordinates with the metric term. And so we're writing that here in kind of like if they were matrices. And using, imagine if these are 4x4 matrices just describing all the different positions. And these are, this is the 4x4 matrix for the metric. These represent either row or column vectors for each of the coordinates. So this is in the unprimed coordinate system. Then you apply this transformation, like a Lorentz transformation. And so you're now have the same Minkowski metric, because we're still in a flat Minkowski space-time, but you have the primed coordinates. The idea is that a Lorentz transformation, this ds squared, should be the same, so these two should be equal to each other. Now, if you pull the transformation matrix out of these primed coordinates here, then what happens is you got this term and this term just kind of pulled out from here. And then you could see that by comparing these, this has to also be equal to this. And you could see the vectors are the same. So therefore, this term, the similarity transformation happening on the metric, does nothing. And so you can almost imagine that this is a 4x4 metric, this is a 4x4 metric, that's a 4x4 metric. And so you can use linear algebra to kind of see how this works. So if this is the same thing, then there's a couple of different ways to analyze this. One is you can actually multiply this side by its inverse, or you can multiply that by its inverse on the front side, you know, just to kind of see what's going on here. But this, if you look element by element, you can write it like this as well. And when you write it element by element, you've moved it from being a linear algebra problem to being like a tensor problem. Okay? And when you have it reduced to a tensor problem, it doesn't matter what order you write them in, so you can put these terms together. And what this does is it can tell you a little bit about what kind of things have to go in to making this work, to where this is effectively going to give you unity or one. So it's almost like it's going to be its own inverse when you look at its transpose. And it also tells you that it has to have a determinant equal to one, because when you take the determinant of everything here, it's like the determinant of this has got to equal the determinant of this times the determinant of this times the determinant of this, and so these both have to have determinant one. So whatever transformation you do has to have a determinant equal to one. And this gives you the Lorentz group, which is, you know, this kind of gets into group theory, which is something we haven't really talked about in any of the classes so far, but what this Lorentz, what this group theory does is it tells you how do you actually group different types of transformations or different types of matrices that make sense. So here, this is called the SO3-1 group. And SO stands for special orthogonal. And where, I guess the special part means that it's determinant equals one. And orthogonal means that they're orthogonal transformations. And so it's very similar to the rotation group, where with the rotation group is called the SO3 group, because the 3 comes from the fact you have a 3x3 rotation matrix, and a special means orthogonal, determinant equals 1. And so orthogonal, or this means the transverse is the inverse. And so for the rotation group, if you take a rotation matrix, you take its transverse, multiply by the rotation matrix, you get back the identity. So whatever makes this Lorentz transformation work, whenever you take its transverse, it's going to be the inverse of that. And it's going to have a determinant equal to 1. So this is what we know about Lorentz transformations. And actually, if this is kind of a good thing to know, because if you ever read a paper on like particle physics or string theory or something like that, you hear about the SU2 groups or SO4 group or something like that. And that's basically the basis of where this is coming from, is all group theory and what the transformations have to do. So, and by the way, if you see SU, that means special unitary, where unitary, I believe, implies Let's see, determine equal to 1. Unitary, I think, is like e to the I theta or something like that, where it's always going to be magnitude 1 or something. All right, now the identity matrix is basically just 1s down the diagonal. Eta, which represents the Minkowski spacetime, is a minus 1, and the rest are 1s down the diagonal. And the determinant of the transformation is going to be equal to 1. Much like with the determinant of rotation matrix is equal to 1. So what happens is you can have, for example, a rotation about the x-axis, or sorry, about the xy plane, which looks like this, where this is just simply a rotation matrix with the 1 out here. All the rest of the terms are 0. And then this is a boost where you could see that you're actually doing kind of a rotation about the xt plane. So if you can imagine, you've got you're rotating respect to time and the x spatial direction. So you're moving a little bit less forward in time, a little bit more forward in x, and you're moving. And so this is a boost, and that's a rotation. And so this makes up Lorentz transformations, which are the SO3-1 group. And again, the reason why this is called the SO3-1 and not the SO4 is because three dimensions of space, one dimension of time. And they're treated a little bit differently here. Also, you should note here that theta, in this case, goes from 0 to 2 pi, and phi goes from minus infinity to infinity. And also, Lorentz transformations don't commute. So if you, you know, the order of these transformations does matter. And so they're called non-abelian. And so that makes them part of what they call a non-abelian group. Now, that means that they're part of a 10-parameter non-abelian group known as the Poincaré's group. And all of that 10 parameters are, you've got three different ways you can rotate. You've got three different ways you can apply boosts. And then you've got, I think, four different ways you can do translations. You know, like if you just add more direction to each one of them. And so that gives you the full Poincaré group. And so Lorentz transformations can be written like this, where it's basically to go from the old time to the new time, you're kind of rotating and you're adding in a little bit of time and a little bit less space, and then you got your new time direction. And the spatial changes likewise. So what happens is velocity, if you think of velocity as x divided by time, then that's sinh over cosh, which is a hyperbolic tangent. And so they refer to this phi term as the rapidity. And the rapidity basically is like a rotation in the space-time. A lot like velocity, but not really. All right. Now, you've got T prime. This is the more common way of writing this. You've got the gamma terms in here, where gamma is 1 over square root of 1 minus v squared. And here I set c equal to 1 because, you know, I don't want to keep writing c's. And you can see here t prime and x prime are written in terms of the old and new times. And, you know, these are just the transformations, just like you're used to. Now for vectors, what we're going to be dealing with here are four vectors as opposed to dealing with three vectors, which means each vector is going to have to contain time and space, not just time. And so each four vector is located at a different point in space-time, And at each point, P, space-time is going to be associated with a set of all possible vectors located at that point. Okay, now this sounds weird, but this is known as tangent space. And so you have to think about this for a minute. You've got every four vector being associated at a different point in space, and that makes a lot of sense, because everywhere you are in space, you can imagine all these different possible vectors pointing out from it. But at each point, you're kind of you're associating the set of all possible vectors at that point. And then you get something that looks kind of like this. Looks kind of like the mortarboard on a graduation cap. And you can imagine it like, if you're at this particular point P, that you've got all these different vectors which represent all the different ways you can move from there. And then if you move just a tiny bit in any direction, the tangent is going to change. And so all the vectors of motion are going to be different. And then you move and it's different. So you're constantly getting a different set of vectors defining everywhere on the space. And this is for curved space-time. In a flat space-time, it's pretty boring because they're all the same everywhere you go. And so this TP, tangent space at point P, is really going to be one thing we're going to use a lot, especially when we get to talk more about curved space-time. A vector bundle is a set of all the vectors exactly one at each point in the space-time. And so, vector field, I got ahead of myself. Vector field is a set of all the vectors with exactly one at each point in space-time. So it's almost like if you could picture like the flow of a fluid or something like that, where every point in the space-time has a vector which represents how that fluid is flowing. Or a magnetic field. It's at each point in space, it can only be really pointing in one direction. And so that's what they mean by a vector field. And then the tangent bundle, when I was reading a little bit ahead, this is a set of all the tangent spaces in an n-dimensional manifold, which are assembled into a 2n-dimensional manifold. So you got to imagine this. You've already got this mortarboard type picture in your mind, where you have this curve and then you have a tangent space to it, or all these tangent vectors. And you have all these tangent spaces in this n-dimensional manifold. And we're not even saying how many dimensions it is. It could be 3 dimensions, could be 4 dimensions, could be 2, could be 12, whatever. Because, I mean, and by the way, all this math that we're talking about here, this is exactly what you would do in like string theory. Or some grand unified theory or whatever. And you're assembling them into a 2n-dimensional manifold. So you basically have going from n dimensions to 2n dimensions, twice as many dimensions. And we're going to define the tangent bundle with respect to the manifold. And then the basis is a set of vectors which is going to span the entire vector space that are going to be linearly independent. So in other words, early on in like math methods, we define the number of dimensions as how many linearly independent vectors you can have. Well, you get general enough that don't even really have to be. That's not necessarily the definition of dimensions. But here, you're still going to have a certain number of linearly independent vectors, and you're going to use those to define the little bases, which could be x, y, z, or r, theta, phi, or whatever. And then the dimension we're going to think of is corresponding to the number of basis vectors. And so for the most part, this is going to be true. And, they may not be orthogonal, but they're definitely going to be linearly independent. And so any vector can be written as a linear combination of all the basis vectors. So basically you add up all the linearly independent vectors and you can get any other vector out of that. And so you could see here the vector A comes from having this component contracted with this basis, etc. Now, V in this case, we can almost think of V as the four velocity, and it is tangent to the curve x mu lambda, which is a path parameterized by lambda, which is something like time. And so if you take the derivative of that, you get something like floor velocity. And so effectively, because this is a derivative, it's like a tangent to the curve. Kind of like, you know, if you take the derivative of anything, you're always basically getting the slope, right? And that slope is the tangent to that curve. So this is kind of a tangent. And you'll notice that it also obeys Lorentz transformations because it's a vector, just like any other vector. And also, it is made up of basis vectors. It can be broken into components and bases. And if you change the basis by doing this Lorentz transformation, it's the same thing as kind of pulling out the Lorentz transformation out of here. And in this case, you could see that you're effectively, when you do that, you're Lorentz transforming the basis. And the reason why this works is because the total distance, the total length of this vector, is still unaltered when you sum over all the...
It's invariant?
Yeah, it's invariant. Because remember, this is a scalar, and scalars are not changed by transformations. So because it's invariant, you know, you're changing this component. It's like changing, when you pull that out, it's just like changing this, and so it all works out. So the net effect of this Lorentz transformation is not going to change the scalar. And also you notice if you do a Lorentz transformation, you contract it with another one, you get back to a delta function. And so in other words, this is basically saying you're transforming from, let's say, from rho to mu prime, and then from mu prime to mu, then it's the same thing as going a delta from one to the other.
So you're contracting them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's contracting, and then it's also, you know, ending up with a delta function. Because also you notice that this is like, since there's difference between the covariant and contravariant here, it's almost like you did a transformation and then an inverse transformation to get back to it. And I bring up dual vectors, and these are known by a lot of different things. Dual vectors, we also call them covariant vectors. We call them, and here they're also known as one-forms. There's a lot of different names for them, but they're basically the same thing. Now, dual vector space is a space of all linear maps from the original vector space to real numbers. So if you want to map from some vector space and you're mapping them to real numbers, which are just scalars, then you're using a dual vector. And all that's basically saying there is you're just contracting the dual vectors and the regular vectors together to get a scalar, doing a dot product. The tangent space that we have for vectors relates to a cotangent space for the dual vectors. And in Cartesian coordinates, they would be the exact same thing. But it basically, all this is really saying is an alternative vector space. You don't have to try to picture it in your brain. If you take, this is basically a fancy way of saying that W is a dual vector, it exists in the tangent space of dual vectors, then we call this the dual, and it's a linear Basically, it's a linear function of these vectors with some scalars. Then this can be written as basically saying the dual acting on this vector with the scalar, and the dual acting on this vector with the scalar, and it's going to yield a real number. And you'll notice that there's a lot of, kind of symbols and language that they use like this, like when they say exist in, and, so exist in, real, or different things like that. Complex or cotangent space, you'll see a lot of asterisk with that. And it's just sort of, it's kind of learning the convention along the way. You also notice here that if you take these two duals, and they're both being acting on this vector space, that there's also this linear thing to it. And so this is kind of where they got the word linear algebra from. The only difference between this and what we do in a math methods is that this is just a little bit more general. And then we also have dual basis vectors. So this is the basis of the dual vector, which does the exact same thing as the basis vector, only it's all flipped over. So that if you put the two of these together, you effectively get a delta function. And it's just like two unit vectors that are, one's a dual and one's a vector, or one's a covariant, one's a contravariant, and they just kind of come together. And either they work together or they don't. And so for each vector, there's basically a dual, which is its covariant counterpart to the contravariant vector. And so you could see that that gives you a delta function, and so we can think of the duals vectors or as this component and the basis. Same way we think of radial vectors. And so you could see that effectively you've got what we normally think of as vectors with a contravariant vector, and then we have the covariant vectors. Okay. And so you got contravariant and covariant, which is vector and dual. And when you take the two and you contract them together, something like this, the result should be a scalar. And you can see that this is just the dual and its basis, and the vector in its basis, and since everything is linear, you can rearrange it like so. And the basis terms here are going to yield a delta function, which means that these two are going to be the same, or it's going to be zero. And if they're the same, then effectively you just have these two components together, which are going to yield a real number. And so whenever you see this or this, it's the same thing as just contracting the covariant and contravariant. Although most of the stuff you're going to see, it's going to basically be just the covariant and contravariant components. And we think of those as the vectors. And we won't spend a lot of time worrying about bases. And then Lorentz transforms of this is the same as Lorentz transform of a vector. And it makes sense because if it wasn't, then, the rest of this stuff really wouldn't work. So if you can Lorentz transform these duals just like you Lorentz transform a regular vector, then that's the same thing. That means that all this stuff that works in flat space-time should work in curved space-time, where the geometry gets more interesting and there's all this other curvature going on. Now, the gradient of a dual vector is basically you take your dual and you take a derivative with respect to some component, and then you still have your basis here, and it gives you this scalar change. So normally you can think of this as if you take the derivatives with respect to the prime coordinate, it's like having a derivative with respect to the unprimed and then a transformation from the unprimed to the primed. And this is effectively a transformation vector, or transformation matrix acting on this. And so for shorthand, whenever we want to take the derivative of something, a partial derivative, we're going to write it like this. And so this is just the partial derivative with respect to some coordinate on there, instead of having to keep writing these x's. And we can also write it like this, where this is just writing the component, comma, what you're taking a derivative with respect to. And this will save you a ton of time when it comes time to do this in the homework. And you can see here that when you take this and we multiply it by 4 velocity here, what's happening is, since this is a derivative of d phi with respect to the coordinate, and this is a derivative of coordinate with respect to the parameter, it ends up contracting together to give you the derivative of this with respect to the parameter. So
would that be a total derivative?
Yeah, that's a total derivative in that case, because it's summing over all the different coordinates to do it. Where this is just a partial derivative with respect to one coordinate. So there's a lot of things you can do with this, because basically it's saying that all of a calculus works. And if all the calculus works, then, you know, there's really no limit. Okay. Questions? Is everything clear? I just need to soak in a little bit. Yeah. Like I said, we've gone, I think we got about halfway through chapter 1. Yeah. The next thing we're going to talk about on Thursday is actually getting into the tensors. And like I said, I mean, this is not a core course. So if there's anything that you need us to just slow down on and, you know, go over more, let me know. You know, preferably let me know a class ahead so I can prepare a little bit. But that way, I'm more interested in you guys learning this stuff than for us to make some kind of imaginary mark. Yeah?
I was late. Did you give us our homework number?
No, I didn't give you the homework yet. I was about to give you that. But also, like I said, all this is recorded, and all of this, if you go to that website that I gave you the website on the syllabus. So if you go to that, then hopefully by tomorrow afternoon at the latest, then you'll see it posted. And with the audio, you can also, you know, download the notes. Should already be on there. And until we get towards the end of the semester, when I don't know exactly what we're covering yet, all the notes for at least the first 15 or so lectures are all already up there. Okay. For your homework, I got you something, and it's going to be due in a couple weeks. I'm not going to show you the full sheet of paper, just the first little bit. But chapter 1 and chapter 2 is a total of 6 problems, and they're going to be due on the 23rd, which is about 2 weeks. Just over 2 weeks from today. And the first chapter, that's mostly going to be some special relativity stuff, which you should already be able to get a jump on the first few, because these are essentially things that you've seen for the most part. The third problem up there is actually one where you have to actually put in some numbers, and you can kind of see the stuff in action. But what I think is going to be interesting is the second set from chapter 2, that's actually getting into some of the manifold stuff. So I kind of meant this to be sort of a, you know, for the first part, it's sort of a review. And then and as we go on, it's going to be a little bit less and less of a review. And you'll notice here, you know, when I really thought about, you know, since this is a 9-week course, I don't want to load you guys up too much. For the second problem set, you know, getting up to 8 problems in a couple weeks, I think that's plenty. But really not going to be a whole lot more than that. Okay, any other questions? Okay. All right, and also, like I said, we're going to, if anybody needs to take breaks or anything while we're going through class, let me know. But these are shorter than the three-hour classes, and we don't have to be here the full 2.5 hours if there's no questions or nothing else to cover. All right, so I also can get the sign-in sheet. Did everybody sign this? Yep, everybody sign. So what I'll do is...